This episode of John Brown's Body is brought to you by the 1851 Navy Revolver by Samuel Colt. Are you tired of only carrying one live round on your belt? Constantly reloading is unfashionable, and carrying up to six pistols on your torso just makes you look like a criminal. Revolving pistols are too heavy and cumbersome, and they have to be carried in the saddlebag. Until now, the 1851 Colt Navy Revolver is the first revolver that can carry up to six rounds and sit comfortably on the belt. Samuel Colt designed this little pistol for naval officers to use in close-quarter combat on the decks of warships. But in the last 4 years, we've seen its applications are seemingly endless. Do you need to revenge murder a room full of Hatfields? Colt Navy's got you covered. Do you need to persuade a judge to count your illegal ballot? Colt Navy's got your back. Do you need to silence a group of guys that just caught you cheating at poker? Trust the Colt Navy. Not only are the applications of the Colt Navy endless, but so are the benefits. People listen to you more, and they do what you tell them to do when you're openly brandishing a shiny Colt Navy pistol. The Colt Navy is power. The Colt Navy is respect. Unless, of course, the other guy has a Colt Navy pistol too. And that's why the Colt Firearms Company recommends adding a second Colt Navy to your belt, doubling your potential output. Got one Colt Navy pistol pointed in your face? Point two Colt Navies in their face. Do you need to simultaneously hold up the bank teller and the security officer? Two is always better than one. The 1851 Navy Revolver by Samuel Colt. God made man, but Colt made efficient firearms at an affordable price. Part 11. Radical. Syracuse, New York, June 26, 1855. Our friend Garrett Smith is hosting the Convention of Radical Political Abolitionists, a three-day convention where some of the most prevalent abolitionists would craft a national political strategy to end slavery once and for all. For decades, these conventions had been going on, and still nothing changed. In fact, the situation was getting worse. But sure, maybe this convention would be different. On day one, the most exciting thing to take place was right after Garrett Smith read aloud the Declaration of Sentiments. A motion was then made that the word annihilation be stricken out and the words outrageous aggression upon human rights be substituted. After fierce argument and debate, the motion narrowly lost. They would keep the word annihilation. Day two, a second motion was made that reverends and honorable should be left off from the persons being recorded. After a fierce debate, the motion narrowly passed. The reverends and the honorables, of course, voting against it. Finally, on day three, Garrett Smith read the letters of John Brown Jr. detailing the perils of their journey west, and also the injustice that had taken place on that first election day on March 30th. Some of the crowd were moved to tears. And then John Brown himself took the stage. He spoke simply and directly. There was a war taking place in Kansas, and if this convention didn't move quickly, furnishing northern settlers with arms and tools for the occupations of war, then the slave power would soon triumph. A number of attendees were outraged by the proposition that the convention of radical abolitionists would ever endorse violence. And again, debate and argument ensued. But following the day's proceedings, that evening, a select few of abolitionists were invited to join Garrett Smith at a private party in his parlor. There, they could meet this rugged John Brown. That night, on June 28th, John Brown became acquainted with about a dozen wealthy and influential people sympathetic towards the cause. He took up a collection of more than $60, which was a nice gesture, but still not enough. The road ahead was long, and while John Brown had all the tough grit required for this journey, he also needed something that had eluded him his entire life. Cash. It would take another 6 weeks to raise enough money, partially from donations and partially from selling a few heads of his prized Devon cattle, about 100 miles west. That way he could sell the cattle away from the prying eyes of his many creditors and debt collectors. But finally, by mid-August, John Brown, his 16-year-old son Oliver, and his son-in-law Henry Thompson had scratched together less than $300. Hopefully that was enough for the over 1,500-mile journey to Kansas. The party begins towards Chicago via railroad. And from Chicago, the party would begin the nearly 800-mile march to fight a war in Kansas. Part 12. A lot of walking. September 4th, 1855, Iowa City. A letter from John Brown.
Dear wife, children, all. I am writing you in our tent, about 20 miles west of the Mississippi, to let you know that we are all in good health. We had some delay at Chicago on account of our freight not getting on as we expected. While there, we bought a stout young horse that proves to be a very good one, but he has been unable to travel fast for several days from having taken the distemper. Our load is heavy, so that we have to walk most of the time, indeed, all of the time. Our expenses before we got away from Chicago had been very heavy, since then very light, so that we hope our money will not entirely fail us, but we shall not have any account left when we get through. We expect to go direct through Missouri, and if we are not obliged to stop on account of our horse, we shall be soon there.
The infallibility of Brown's spirit makes it difficult to understand how difficult this journey was. Now, Garrett Smith had donated a crate of pistols and rifles, and Brown also had a box of donated swords and his heavy surveying implements. All of that freight was strapped on the back of that poor little horse, and everything else had to be carried by John Brown and his two travel companions, his son-in-law, Henry Thompson, and his 16-year-old son, Oliver. For 13 days, that small party walked nearly 80 miles west, ever so slightly uphill. At Iowa City, the horse was already showing signs of fatigue. If they continued the same way they had been, the horse would surely die before reaching St. Louis. Also, Yankees caught walking through Missouri with a crate full of weapons would surely be killed. So they purchased a large covered wagon for $100 in Iowa, which immediately improved things for the poor horse. However, the freight was still very heavy, so the three men would take turns driving the wagon as the other two walked along the wagon. The weapons were covered with a tarp, and Brown laid his heavy surveyor's equipment over the tarp, and so if anybody asked, he would say he was a surveyor sent by the government to map the new farms in the Kansas Territory. From Iowa City, the party headed south to St. Louis, where they purchased a small stove and some new boots, which Jason Brown had requested from Osawatomie. This was pretty much the rest of their money. They couldn't afford to buy food. Instead, they would rely on shooting game along the trail. From St. Louis, the party turns west and once again makes the slight yet noticeable ascent towards Kansas. After a week of walking from St. Louis, John, Henry, and Oliver arrive at a small tree outside of the town of Waverly, Missouri. The cart stops. John pulls a crumpled piece of paper from his pocket. He reads the paper, looks around, and nods his head. "This is the place." And the three men grab shovels from the wagon and start digging. It didn't take very long for them to find the body of little Austin Brown, loosely wrapped in a blanket, whose body had been lying, moldering in that shallow grave for nearly 8 months. They load the little boy's body onto the cart and continue their journey west with the last piece of freight they needed to deliver to Kansas. Finally, 2 weeks after Waverly, on October 7th, the second Brown party arrives in Osawatomie to a dismal sight. Almost every member of the Brown party was sick with ague.
which is most likely a form of malaria. Ague had plagued the Browns in Kansas, rendering most of them useless all summer long. So by the time John Brown arrived in October, with winter quickly approaching, very little land was plowed or tilled for planting, and what few crops they could sow were rotting on the stalk. Worse than that, they were still living in the flimsy tents that they had made out with in St. Louis. John Brown writes his wife in North Elba about what his initial arrival looked like. "We found all more or less sick or feeble, but wealthy and jolly. Fever and ague and chill fever seemed to be very general. Oliver has had a turn of the ague since we got here, but has got it broken. We met with no difficulty in passing through Missouri, but from the sickness of our horse and our heavy load. We had, between us all, 60 cents in cash when we arrived. We found our folks in a most uncomfortable situation, with no houses to shelter one of them, no hay or corn fodder of any account secured, shivering over their little fires, all exposed to the dreadful cutting winds, morning and evening and stormy days. We've been trying to help them all in our power, and hope to get them more comfortable soon. I think much of their ill health is owing to most unreasonable exposure." The first thing that needed to be done was to create a suitable shelter for the coming fall and winter. So the most sick and feeble were sent to a close family friend's house about 8 miles away. His name was Mr. Adair. And the men healthy enough to contribute start building wooden shanties, 3 logs high, and the tents would be used as the roof. They were drafty, with dirt floors, and no adult could stand upright while inside, but it was dry and spacious enough to fit a small stove to keep warm indoors through the coming winter. Over the next 6 weeks, John Brown does what he can for his struggling sons. Eventually, John has to sell the horse and wagon to buy the potatoes, cornmeal, hardtack, and other food rations that his sons failed to plant during the summer. As eager as John Brown was to commit himself to that most holy combat against slavery, his sons and grandchildren would have died without his intervention. "To my family in North Elba, from Osawatomie, Kansas Territory, November 23rd, 1855. Dear wife and children all, nothing new of account has occurred amongst us since I last wrote. Henry, Jason, and Oliver are unable to do much yet, but appear to have but little ague now. The others are all getting middling well. We have got both families so sheltered that they need not suffer hereafter. I've got part of the hay, which had been laying in cocks, secured. Made some progress in preparation to build a house for John and Owen, and Solomon has caught a prairie wolf in a steel trap. We continue to have a good deal of stormy weather, rains with severe winds, and forming into ice as they fall, together with the cold nights that freeze the ground considerably. Still, God has not forsaken us, and we get by day our daily bread. And I wish we all had a great deal more gratitude to mingle with our undeserved blessings. Still, I sometimes allow myself to dream a little of again sometime enjoying the comforts of home, but I do not dare to dream too much. Your affectionate father and husband, John Brown."
In less than 1 week, John Brown and his able-bodied sons will be marching north towards Lawrence to participate in the Wakarusa War.
"Now I'm broken, I'm hungry, ragged and dirty too. Broken, hungry, ragged and I'm dirty too."
Part 13. A Recipe for a Civil War. By the fall of 1855, there were two separate governments in Kansas Territory. The pro-slavery government out of the dusty town of Shawnee, Kansas, just 6 miles from the Missouri border. Then there was the Free State government, operating in the bustling town of Topeka, nearly 70 miles to the west. Both had governors, legislatures, and their very own constitutions. However, the Shawnee government had dominated that entire summer because one, it was the one officially recognized by the U.S. federal government, but more importantly, the Shawnee government had an army of 2,000 to 4,000 armed Missouri volunteers ready to foray into Kansas territory at a moment's notice. This army could evict abolitionist families, make arrests, and seize property in the name of the Shawnee government. The Topeka Constitution was worthless without means to enforce it. It was nothing more than some groovy idea found on a far-off chat room. But in the fall of 1855, thousands of guns arrived from the north. The New England Emigrant Aid Society alone was responsible for furnishing the Free State settlers with 400 Sharps rifles and dozens of pistols. Another Emigrant Aid Society successfully smuggled 2 cannons into Lawrence, Kansas. And now the Topeka government could begin enforcing its own laws. So now we have one piece of land with 2 separate governments, both claiming to be in charge and both having their own armies. If you throw a pinch of petty score settling and a splash of alcohol, you've got the perfect recipe for a civil war. And to make things even more complicated and dangerous, there was no longer a Mason-Dixon line. There was no longer a hard border separating the 2 ideologies. Between the 2 growing free state towns of Lawrence and Topeka was the pro-slavery stronghold of Lecompton. Most pro-slavery towns on the Kansas-Missouri border were situated north of the free state residents in Topeka and Lawrence. To meet up with the Alabama or Georgian ruffians camped in Pottawatomie, the Missouri ruffians would have to sneak past Brown's Run in Ossawatomie. Most Missouri ruffians would have to ride south to fight those northern abolitionists. But that's just it. That's what inspired thousands of Southerners to arm themselves and head to Kansas. They saw these settlers as invaders, looking to abolish slavery on their own southern flank. On October 25th, 1855, near Hickory Point, Kansas, an argument breaks out on the streets between pro-slavery and free soil residents. But this time, both groups are armed. So the verbal argument devolves into a gun battle on the streets. Multiple shots were fired, but it was the pro-slavery man Pat Laughlin who successfully shot Samuel Collins in the chest, killing him instantly. And Samuel Collins, the Free State man, becomes the first official casualty of the Wars of Bleeding Kansas. Part 14, the beginning of the Wakarusa War. November 21st, 1855, Hickory Point, Kansas Territory. Jacob Branson, an old farmer and a Free State man, a few weeks earlier had attended a territorial convention in Topeka. Hickory Point was mostly occupied by pro-slavery residents, so it was dangerous for Branson to show his face in public. However, he did need to pick up a few supplies from the blacksmith. Luckily, a young man boarding at Branson's home named Charles Dow volunteered to go into town instead. Branson offered to lend Dow his pistol, but Dow said no. He was only going to take a few hours at most. And so he left, unarmed. A few hours came and went with no sign of the young Dow's return. Branson grew worried. Finally, as the sun was starting to set, a man rode up to Branson's house and confirmed Branson's deepest fears. "There's a dead body lying by the roadside," said the man. So, under the cover of night, Branson makes his way into the town, and just outside of the blacksmith's shop lay Charles Dow's body. A man by the name of Franklin Coleman had unloaded both barrels of a double-barreled shotgun into Dow's chest, killing him instantly. Branson collected the dead body and went home. That evening, while Branson was sitting at home, there was a knock at the door.
"Who's there?"
Branson nervously asked. From behind the door, a voice said, "A friend."
"Well, come in then,"
Branson replied. And in burst more than a dozen armed, half-drunk ruffians. The posse was led by a man named Samuel Jones. This was the same Jones that held John Wakefield at gunpoint in Bloomington, Kansas, during the bogus election back in March. The pro-slavery legislature that he had voted on appointed Jones to be the sheriff of Douglas County and gave him all discretionary powers to enforce the laws of their constitution. Sheriff Jones dug the barrel of his pistol into Branson's chest. "You are my prisoner," said Jones.
"By what authority?" answered Branson.
Jones pulls back the hammer on his pistol. "I will blow you through." And the rest of the men seized Branson and tied his hands. Officially, Sheriff Jones was enforcing a peace warrant. Basically, Branson's pro-slavery neighbor knew he had attended the Topeka Free State Convention and turned his neighbor in. Though Branson had committed no acts of violence or theft, he was accused of violating multiple laws under the Shawnee Constitution for causing to bring into publication a document denying the right for a man to own slaves in the territory. The punishment for that crime was death. But meanwhile, in the small community of Blanton, a group of Free State men were gathered at Major James B. Abbott's home. They had caught wind of their comrade's arrest and were arguing over a rescue for the following morning. There were dozens of ways that Sheriff Jones and his posse could deliver Jacob Branson to Lecompton the next day, but as it just so happens that night, the posse decided to take the route over the Blanton Bridge to cross the Wakarusa, just outside of Colonel Abbott's home. The group of nearly 15 men see the approaching posse, and in the dark of night, they make their way onto the streets to set up for an ambush. As Jones and his posse approached, the Free Staters then stepped into the road. They had the drop on Sheriff Jones and his ruffians. The scene was tense. Both sides tried their very best to look tough. The Free State leader, Major Abbott, coolly set his hand on his Colt Navy revolver, but perhaps he was a bit nervous, because as he put his hand over his Colt Navy, everyone jumped, but nobody was hurt. Major Abbott had accidentally grazed the trigger of his pistol a bit too hard. But after a brief exchange of words, Sheriff Jones and his posse decided to release Jacob Branson to the Free Staters. But before Sheriff Jones left, he had this to say to the Free Statemen. "Kansas militia, 3,000 strong in 3 days' time, would wipe that damned abolition town Lawrence out and corral all the abolitionists and make pits of them." Jones then spurred his horse, and the rest of his posse followed as they rode away into the dark night. Branson was no longer safe at his home in Hickory Point, so he was quickly transferred to Lawrence, Kansas, the Free State military stronghold. And when Sheriff Jones arrives in Lecompton, he sends out two dispatches. One to Governor Shannon in Shawnee, and a second to his father-in-law, Colonel Boone, the grandson of the famous Daniel Boone. And as that second dispatch made its way from Lecompton to his father-in-law, Sheriff Jones is quoted as saying this: "This man has taken my dispatch to Missouri, and by God, I will have my revenge before I see Missouri again." As promised, within days,
A force of between 2,000 and 3,000 Missouri ruffians were seen marching towards Wakarusa County in the little town of Lawrence. But as the ruffian army approached from the north, from the south, and Osawatomie, came John Brown and four of his able-bodied sons. These men were gaunt, sick, and half-starved. Yet each man was equipped with one Sharps rifle and a pair of Colt revolvers on their belts. The Wakarusa War was about to begin. Next time on John Brown's Body, John Brown receives the nickname Captain Brown. And Bleeding Kansas very quickly turns to a fucking disaster. The stories for today's episode were brought to you by the Kansas Herald of Freedom, an abolitionist newspaper out of Lawrence, Kansas, the Kansas Free State newspaper, the second abolitionist newspaper out of Lawrence, Kansas, and also the Squatters Sovereign, the pro-slavery newspaper being written in Atchison, Kansas at the same time. And of course, The Life and Letters of John Brown by Franklin Benjamin Sanborn. And of course, you've probably noticed the music has taken quite a big turn. Music for today's episode is no longer provided by myself. Instead, all of the music is taken from the archives of royalty-free music recorded over the last century through the Library of Congress. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Well, every time I look, baby, she be on my mind.